bakers are always looking for that one little tweak that they can do that will give them a competitive advantage. When you start mixing again, the dough gets a little tighter and firmer because the salt acts as kind of like this kind of rubber band around it, and it kind of brings the dough together. I coined this, what I call the corollary of baking, which is that all fresh baked bread is a hit no matter how it comes out, and never apologize for your loaf. They want to know what great is. They want to know what excellence is.
The Culinary Libertarian Podcast, episode 51.
Welcome to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast, where the philosophy is free, but the food is on you.
Hello, folks. Welcome back to the podcast. Dan Reed here, the Culinary Libertarian. Happy to have you here. Happy to be here. A little bit of prep, so to speak, before we get rolling here. Head over to my podcasts page, culinarylibertarian.com/podcasts, and follow me on my Eating Liberty Facebook group. We've got bakers and cooks and just the interested sharing recipes and successes and, well, so far no failures, about the things they're cooking or things they're interested in. The only thing we're missing is you. You can also find all of my social media buttons, Twitter, Gab, Minds, on the podcast page. And you can also subscribe to my YouTube channel, where I post some baking and cooking videos. Coffee drinkers can find a variety of sassy or sweet coffee mugs at my Cranky Without Coffee store, linked on the podcast page. And for breakfast, you can download my Muffins e-cookbook, Foolproof Muffins, recipes that work every time. Just click the link, leave me your email address, and download the book. And I'll send you a few emails or so a week. The last way you can help support the show is with a few clicks of the mouse to your favorite podcatcher and leave a 5-star rating and a review. Those kinds of engagements help move the show up so more people can find it and listen. Reading a recipe can sometimes make you feel inept because there just isn't enough information to help you succeed. You read the words, mix, fold, portion, bake. You go through the steps, but the finished product just isn't what you want. Education is like that too. We know the names, Roosevelt, Lincoln, Reagan, and the words, emancipation, depression, recession. But the part that makes it all come together is missing. Bite back against poorly written history with a master class membership from Liberty Classroom. Liberty Classroom offers drive time length audio courses on politics, history, economics, and even sci-fi and dystopia, and a course on Laura Ingalls Wilder. Each instructor at Liberty Classroom digs deep to give you the full account so your knowledge recipe is complete. If you are prepping for dinner, you can also watch the corresponding video. Click through with my affiliate link, culinarylibertarian.com/biteback. With the master level subscription, not only do you get access to all the courses at Liberty Classroom, you get access to all additional courses for as long as the site exists. That access is for life. That's right. The master level is a lifetime membership which grows as more content is added. That means access to recommended reading and resources to accompany the courses, Liberty Classroom question and answer forums where you can get your questions answered by the faculty, monthly live sessions where the faculty answer your questions and discuss issues with you in real time, and there's a special bonus. The 435 audio and video lessons on government and history created by Tom Woods for the Ron Paul curriculum. Purchased separately, that costs $250, but it's a bonus for the master level membership. As an additional bonus, When you subscribe at the master class level, email me a copy of your receipt and I'll schedule a 1-hour Skype call with you so we can talk about cooking or baking. And I'll also send you a link so you can download my cookbook with over 75 recipes for hearty fall dishes, which are perfect for any time of the year, and a link to an ebook about herbs and spices. Use my link, culinarylibertarian.com/biteback, and bite back against the failed education from the state. My guest today is Peter Reinhart. Peter returns to the show to talk some baking basics. Peter was with us a few episodes ago to discuss his book, Perfect Pan Pizza. Today, we're getting a bit more basic and finding out how to get success with some basic principles of baking and mixing. With the almost overwhelming amount of content online and in print, young in-skill bakers can be unsure how to proceed. We're going to try to sort that out. Welcome back, Peter. Thank you for joining me again on the Culinary Libertarian Podcast.
Thank you, Dan. Good to be here.
All right. So we spoke last. We talked a lot about your pizza book, and my observation then remains so that it's worth doing, but one of the biggest challenges is the time budget versus having a round piece of dough maybe you bought from your grocery store and you turn that into a pizza pie, which the pizza pies are great. I think you've even got a book about pizza pies, but the Detroit pizza, it's worth the time to do it right.
Well, I think so. It's not like you're standing there watching the dough rise. I mean, you can be doing other things if you just plan accordingly. And there are probably lots of shortcuts where you don't have to wait as long as I ask you to do. But you get what you pay for, so to speak.
Well, it is amazing. And I use the Levan version. But that's still just more planning, but, today I want
to brave.
Go ahead.
I say you're brave to have done it without yeast. It's like flying without a safety net underneath.
That's okay.
The sourdough method, and you know, using a natural levain like that is always going to make the best product possible. But it does require even more patience than the other method.
Well, it does. Yes, patience is a thing that I think bakers have probably more than cooks, and that's just comes with the nature of what it is that you're working with.
I think it also depends on how much coffee you're drinking. I found this correlation between people who drink a lot of coffee and a lack of patience. For some reason, the more revved up you are on caffeine, the more you want things to happen fast.
Well, I think there's probably something to that. Maybe that's your next book.
That's been my experience anyway.
The coffee cooks or something anyway. So one of the things I wanted to talk about today was to get into just some more, well, I guess I'll call them basics. I don't want to make it sound diminutive by calling them basics, because the basics are the building blocks on which probably any skill, if you're a guitar player or a wood carver, there are some basic skills you need to have, and you're not going to be Jimmy Page or Angus Young until you learn some basic chords and some basic mixolydian and all that stuff. So,
well, you just destroyed my Jimmy Page fantasy.
Sorry. Work hard. Okay. So let's talk about some basics in the benevolent sense that these are things that we're going to use on which we're going to build our baking skills. And I'm envisioning probably the target audience for a conversation like this mostly as anybody really who's interested in learning, but maybe the home baker who reads the recipe and says something about these words is not making the complete picture in my head. So we're going to find ways maybe we can help that. But let's talk first about flavor versus taste. What do you see as the difference, and how can we improve those?
Yeah, well, for many people, the terms are fairly synonymous and interchangeable, but technically speaking, they're not. When we refer to taste in a culinary sense, we're talking about the five taste zones on our palate, on our tongue, which are, you know, salt, sweet, bitter, sour, and umami, or rich. And those are taste sensations that register in kind of a two-dimensional sense. But if we want to make it three-dimensional, then you have to factor in the olfactory senses, which is more of aromas and the experience that we have not on the tongue itself, but in the olfactory regions of our brain. It's kind of like if you watch something, look at something with one eye only, you see it in two dimensions. But if you look at it with two eyes and you get that sort of stereo effect, you get depth. And so flavor, I think, is really referring to the depth of all of these senses working together. You could even probably make a case for sound being a sense, but I think it has more to do with the aroma factor. They'll say if you can most of the taste that you get or the flavor experience you get from a glass of wine is in the olfactory zone, not on the tongue, but it all starts there. So that's really just to flesh that out. It's probably very important to breathe deeply and get a good scent of what it is you're making, and that will deepen your experience of its flavor.
Well, that's probably as concise an answer as possible to give. And I think in the case of a well-baked bread, I would absolutely agree that sound I think it's critical, but it also creates the anticipation of what's to come. I think that that's kind of fun because you hear that crackle crunch as you're cutting it. I think for people who know what that means, oh my gosh, they're cutting bread. There's an excitement in the air. I don't think that same sound applies to, say, a Danish or a croissant or a cinnamon roll. So there, scent definitely makes a big difference because a really fabulous high butter croissant I like mine baked a little bit more than most people because I like that flaky, crunchy outside, but I also like the deepened caramel that comes from better toasted outside. I don't like flaccid croissants. It makes sense. I walk away. It's too irritating.
Well, it's, I think the Europeans understand that more intuitively than Westerners, than Americans, because we do want things fast. And so sometimes we'll underbake products thinking that we'll get more shelf life from them, but we're sacrificing that flavor experience that is immediate and maybe won't last as long, but it's worth it.
Right. And every cook and every baker, whether they know this or not, strives for that Proustian Madeleine moment. And I think we can at least increase our odds by making the baked, especially the Viennoise and the pastries, baking them a little bit more. Because when they sit in the case, they're going to soften up anyway. So you have at least the caramel flavor, if you've lost some of the crunch. And that's the kind of thing, that little detail to me, is one of the ways you can make a big difference in the lasting memory of that person's experience. Like, oh my gosh, I have got to go back to that place and get that thing. Because, 40 years later, they still remember it. And that's, like I said, I don't think you can seek out that reaction, but man, they'll let you know when it happens.
Well, I think it goes back to aroma also because, building into that anticipation, the aromasticity of any baked product is a big part of the experience. It's one of the reasons why real estate agents tell you to bake cookies when you're trying to sell your house is you fill the house up with the scent of those baked goods and people come into the house and they feel like they want to buy the house. So, there's something working on that subconscious level as well. And it's real in terms of aromas, the esters and the vapors that are coming out of a loaf of bread or any kind of baked product, fill the room and trigger all sorts of sensory responses so that we are starting to eat the product even before we take our first bite.
Yeah, I had forgotten about that tip. But that's a good idea. Bake something. All right, we're going to sort of kind of just jump all over the place here.
Okay.
I have read some articles discussing the breakdown of gluten in sourdough breads which leads them, at least in part, to be easier to digest for folks preferring less gluten. Now, I'm not sure if you've been reading about that.
Yeah, pretty hot theory right now.
Yeah, and I think something, so let's throw a term out here, and it's phytic acid in sourdough. Can you talk about what's going on there?
Phytic acid actually is nature's way of protecting a seed from predators. It not only has its own little bitterness and unpleasant flavor, but it also makes the nutritional aspects of whatever that seed is, it's like a barrier between your stomach or the predator's stomach, if it's an insect or a bird or something like that, and its ability to break down and absorb the nutrients. And so it exists on the surface of wheat berries or rye berries or grains of any type. And it's one of the reasons why whole wheat bread, when the flour is milled and turned into bread, if the bread is made by a pretty fast method, like yeast and quick rise and shape and bake again, you're not going to get the full value of nutrition that's inherent and possible within that whole wheat, because the phytic acid is fighting your own microbiome, your gut, and preventing your gut from absorbing that. And it ends up passing through your system, and it leaves the other end. During the digestive process, our body's working to try to break through all of those barriers to digestion by using enzymes and acids and all sorts of things to break it down. So phytic acid is a natural defense against that. There is an enzyme called, I think it's phytase, that will start to break that down. And actually, two ways that you can eliminate it or reduce the amount of phytic acid in wheat, as our main example, is long fermentation, because then the natural enzymes that are working during the fermentation process start to break it down, and sprouting the grain. So that's one of the reasons why sprouted wheat and sprouted grains are becoming so popular and more digestible to us than regular whole wheat flour, is because in the sprouting process, the phytic acid is broken down and basically eliminated, thus removing a big barrier to our abilities, our body's ability to absorb, to reap the benefits of those grains. So it makes it what we call more bioavailable, the nutrients. So, and long fermentation, which is a natural result of sourdough fermentation, especially if you're doing a 2 to 3 day process, accomplishes a lot of that same, result. So that's one of the theories of why sourdough is maybe more tolerable by people with wheat sensitivities than regular bread, than what we call commercial bread made with yeast. So that's the operating theory of the day. And I think it has merit. We're seeing anecdotal evidence. I think that we're waiting for some definitive study to come out to really prove it. But all the indicators are that, either of those or both of them in combination can greatly enhance the body's ability to reap the benefits of wheat and rye and other grains without the negative associations that we hear about through some of the books that are trying to get us away from eating those grains.
And so this would be something that a person who has legitimately a celiac issue would have to decide for himself or for herself what level of sensitivity that person has and whether or not this is something that you could eat.
Yeah.
That's not, no other person can make that decision.
I think that it is true. I think, you know, it's a different situation when you have a true genetic celiac condition, because that puts you in a different category than somebody who has a general wheat sensitivity or gluten sensitivity that's not celiac based. The degree of sensitivity will also, there are celiacs who can eat a certain amount of wheat because their degree of sensitivity has not gone to the hyper sensitive level. But people who have experienced a health crisis because at some point their celiac disease tipped over and started shutting their body down, they become hypersensitive for the rest of their life. And even long fermentation sourdough, I would say stay away from it because it's high risk.
I worked with a young girl who I had never met anybody as sensitive as she was.
Yeah.
She ate a French fry fried in the fat that previously held something wheat fried. The gluten remaining in the fat on the fry would be enough to, well, we won't get into the gory details.
Yeah.
But she it was not a good response.
No.
And that was,
there are people at that level. I haven't had a similar friend who was so sensitive that one time a chef did everything, you know, to try to please her and keep her safe, did everything right. And at the end, to try to enhance the flavor, splashed a little malt vinegar on her potatoes and that and barley, which is where this malt comes from, has the lowest amount of gluten of any grain, but it has gluten. And that little splash was just enough to send her to the hospital. So I'm always thinking in terms of people at that level when I caution people that, you know, even the positive signs, you know, still all bets are off if you've got celiac disease. But celiac disease only affects about 1.3% of the world's population, whereas gluten sensitivity is closer to about 5%. So that means there's like 3.5% other people that can possibly benefit from the, you know, these discoveries and the evidence of long fermentation or sprouted grain doughs. So, you know, there's hope for those folks who've been kind of avoiding wheat. Plus the bread tastes better.
Oh, no doubt. Absolutely. That is absolutely true. A couple of years ago, I worked with a young man, a young apprentice, who was brought over to the U.S. to help a bakery start. And he was quite skilled in croissant making, but also because the French system is different. He was a young person in years, but he had a lot of experience. And one of the things that I've never seen before was a mixing method I found very interesting, which is completely contrary to everything we as Americans are taught about mixing. So we would say, put all the water, then all of the dry ingredients, mix your dough slow, mix your dough fast, take it out, ferment, brew, ferment, all that stuff. For nearly everything he did, except the enriched doughs, he held back 10% of the water to be added at the end of the mixing.
Uh-huh.
So water first, then flour, yeast, salt, mix 4 minutes slow, 4 minutes fast, then add that 10% of water back on slow speed because, you know, you're going to wear it. But it had, now we had a language barrier and we spoke with, you know, we could get along fine with this and that. But when it came to serious stuff, we were all thumbs on Google Translate. So the nuances of a really complicated conversation simply didn't get to happen.
Right.
But my observation was that by doing the little bit of water at the end, it really, really worked that gluten in a way that just mixing for 5 more minutes would have made it too hot. And we got just the most amazing crumb out of our baguettes. And I wanted to just ask you if you've seen that, if you use it, and what your experience with it is.
Yeah, there are a lot of artisan bakers who do use that technique. They hold back some of the water. They do it with the very wet doughs like ciabatta dough. Especially because they like the idea of letting that dough develop and giving the gluten a head start. The gliadin and the gluten and do need time to bond and form up. And probably by not overhydrating it at the beginning, you know, it's possible that it's creating a stronger bond at the beginning. And then when they add the additional water at the end, it kind of acts almost like a lubricant. And the gluten is already prepared and ready for it, and then it just kind of allows it to absorb and stretch. I haven't done my own tests on that, you know, side by side. I mean, in theory, it all makes sense, and the results speak for themselves. So it is an extra little step, and bakers are always looking for that one little tweak that they can do that will give them a competitive advantage against other bakers, whether they're trying to compete for market share or for competitions or whatever. That's a very viable, you know, classic technique, actually.
Well, I was interested by it. But as you say, the results speak for themselves. The baguettes were just a straight mix and would not have produced that same result. And we weren't using any Levan. It was always just, you know, the water and the flour fresh that day. But that little tweak, man, it just was an astonishing difference. And we played with, so I'm going to use another term here, MLAs. Uh-huh. We do that and maybe we didn't do it long enough. Maybe all of the other factors that went into bread production didn't make that a noticeable change in the texture and flavor of the finished product.
When you say used MLAs, you mean you added it as an ingredient?
Well, maybe I'm using the wrong word. So when you...
Autolyse. I think you're talking about
That's the word.
Because amylase is also a term. That's an enzyme. But autolyse is the resting period.
And yes, that's the one.
Again, another very popular artisan technique. And the reason that it's effective and the reason that people like it is that it does reduce the amount of mixing time, which means that you're also reducing the amount of oxidation that takes place in your dough. Because when you're mixing a dough, you're whipping oxygen into it. And oxidation can essentially and very subtly bleach out some of the flavor that's part of the beta carotene pigments in the flour. And it's a very pleasant flavor and aroma, both. So basically, longer mixing will bleach your flour. And by reducing the mixing time, you retain that flavor. So what the autolyse does is you mix the dough with just the flour and the water. You can add the yeast if you want, or you can wait until a 20-minute or so resting period. By then, the flour has absorbed fully all that water, and the gliadin and glutenin have found each other and are bonded, and they're ready to be kind of organized in the final mix. And then you can add in your final ingredients. You can add your salt, and by holding back on the salt before the autolyse, the flour hydrates more quickly and deeply, because salt kind of slows that hydration down. Then you put everything in, and the first thing you notice when you start mixing again is the dough gets a little tighter and firmer, because the salt acts as kind of like this kind of rubber band around it, and it kind of brings the dough together and tightens it up, which is a good thing. And then you can add your additional water, adjust it as needed till you get the dough exactly where you want it. And you can finish the mixing in just a couple of minutes instead of going for 8 or 10, consecutive minutes, which, as you said, not only brings in more oxygen, but also warms the dough up through friction of the mixer. So by reducing friction, again, you're keeping the dough on the cooler side, which controls fermentation. In the end, bottom line of all this is to say that the theory is do only enough mixing to get the job done. If you can get the job done with minimal amount of mixing, all the better, because you're going to preserve flavor. And one of the ways to achieve that is by letting the dough rest. Another way to achieve it is by doing a series of stretch and folds. After you've done your minimum mixing, then instead of continuing to mix, on the machine, just fold the dough over at 5 to 20 minute intervals. And each time you fold it, it almost like acts as if a whole minute of additional mixing has taken place. So there's all these little tricks that bakers are coming up with to make that very, very subtle difference.
When one gets into really the deep weeds of mixing the ingredients and time and temperature, and it's just, it can be a scary thing for a young baker to open a baking book and then read probably more than they should know. And this is kind of a stupid thing to say, but if you're going to learn about guitar playing, you're not going to start with Andres Segovia, 8-string, double picking. It's like, wait a minute, let's just learn what is the C chord.
Yeah, right.
And so it can be off-putting. It's like, never mind, I'm going to go to the store and get a baguette and that'll be fine.
Well, it can be overwhelming and intimidating to get too much information at the beginning, but you're right. The nice thing is you just make a basic loaf and just follow the steps, mixing and shaping and everything that they give you in the recipe, you're going to get a good loaf. And then after that, you're going to go, okay, now I got a good loaf. How can I make an even better loaf? and late. And the more times you bake, the more of a knowledge base that you have to add the more fine tuning tweaks that will come later. And but this first loaves might not be the best loaves you ever make, but they may be the most memorable because they're your first successful loaves. And that's kind of an initiation into life in itself.
You know, and I think you're right. And I think probably for the home baker, I was just thinking maybe one of the best ways to learn, because one of the, you made the comment, mix it until it's just enough. So the first question is, well, how do I know what that is?
Yeah.
So a no-knead bread, and I was all against the whole no-knead bread thing. And I ran into it about a year ago.
Yeah.
And I said, you know what? I'm going to look into this because maybe there's something to this. Well, it turns out there's a lot to this. Yeah. So we go way back to the Egyptian bakeries, and they made like 10-kilo size loaves of no-knead bread because the French hadn't figured it out yet. So I thought, there's something to this. So I started working with it, saying, you know, this is a great way for a young, inexperienced baker to learn what dough is and what dough does. And
yeah,
and it's bread added. It's almost, it's minimalist bread. I'm borrowing somebody's words, but it's to just mix that. And so you learn the patience of time, because really 24 hours is going to give you the best loaf, but it's going to be kind of tricky to work with because it's going to stick. And so that's a weird feeling that I'm sure you experience all the time. You get young bakers and then like, oh my gosh, it's touching me. What do I do? So there's a lot to be learned, but it can be done in a way that success can lead to greater success as opposed to frustration leading to never doing bread again. And for me, the thing is, let's find success however we have to. We're not talking about people going in and being pastry chefs and professional bakers. I want people to go at home and figure out, you know what, I want to make a loaf of bread because I'm going to have a cocktail party. Or I'm going to have spaghetti dinner. I want to make garlic bread. Whatever it is. Who cares what it is?
Yeah.
Get in the kitchen and bake something without the concern that you aren't measuring up to some really impossible to meet standard. And that's what I want to get to.
Well, that goes back to something I wrote about in my very first book. And the very first book was real basic baking as far as, you know, I didn't even know myself any of the techniques I wrote about later in my later books. It was just, you know, mix for 3 minutes and then mix for another 4 minutes on speed two and, you know, rise, shape, rise again and bake. And I came to the conclusion after having some good breads and not so good breads and serving them to people that people loved them, even the not so good ones, they still loved them, because they were fresh out of the oven and they were home baked. And so I coined this, what I called the corollary of baking, which is that all bread is a hit, no matter how, all fresh baked bread is a hit, no matter how it comes out, and never apologize for your loaf. And that got me over that hump, because I realized that even the ones, I had some baguettes that just kind of fell on me, you know, as I scored them and with the blades, and they just collapsed and flattened out. And they, when they baked up, they had all these wrinkly tops and everything. They didn't look anything like they were supposed to, but I sliced them up and put them in bread baskets, and I was serving 30 people. I was a cook in a seminary, and I put that bread out, and people were coming up to me afterwards going, that was the most amazing bread I've ever had. How did you get that really cool design in the top of the loaves? You
know? Here's the practice.
Because they didn't know that they were failures. They thought I did it intentionally.
Right. Well, and I think one of the things that you would agree with is the bread made from hands with love has to be good, regardless of its aesthetics.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's take our bread step one more. Let's talk about, we're going to do levain, which is the... Why we're going to take flour and water mixed together. We're going to capture the wild yeast that's in the air in the kitchen, and we're going to turn this into our starter. So at some point, no matter what we're going to call the starter, a chef, a poulet, a biga, at some point, the yeast has given up the ghost and we've reached entropy. Now, what can we do with this thing? And how do we know when the Levan has stopped functioning and is just this blob, what do we do with it if it looks like it's too old?
Well, usually, if you've had it and have been keeping it in the refrigerator, and let's say you had a nice starter and you haven't used it for a while, and you return to it a month later, and it's probably separated, there's a little grayish liquid floating on top, which when you smell it, it smells a little bit like apple cider vinegar.
Oh, knock your socks off.
Yeah, and basically what that is alcohol. It's grain alcohol from the grain. The gold miners used to call it hooch because they would trade that with the Hoochin Indians in Alaska for food and furs and things like that because it was pure alcohol and it would knock your socks off. But the point being that the yeast and the bacteria that were the leavening agents and the flavoring agents of that starter have not died off completely. They've just gone dormant. But the acids that they created, because the bacteria, the lactic bacteria creates lots of lactic acid and acetic acid. And so it kind of destroys the structural integrity of the dough. The wheat has no more gluten left in it. It feels almost like putty, you know, when you can pull it apart. So it seems like it's not going to be any good. But the fact is that there's still a whole colony of great organisms alive and just, you know, waiting to be brought back to life. So what you do is you take a small amount of that. Like we'll use a ratio of 1 to 4. So you take 1/4 of that starter, and I'll start with just 1 ounce, and I'll dig in the center of that little putty pile that we just, you know, have, and get 1 ounce of that and put it in a bowl, and then put 4 ounces of fresh bread flour, you know, of new bread flour. So it's 4 to 1. And then I'll put in just enough water, which typically would be about 3 ounces, about 75% of the new flour, about enough water to be able to make a little piece of bread dough out of that. And if you kind of knead that with a spoon or by hand or whatever for a few minutes, you'll have a piece of dough that weighs approximately 8 ounces, about a half a pound of dough. And that's your new refreshed starter. Don't throw away your old starter because it's kind of like your little insurance policy. But if you put that new starter that you made in a clean bowl, cover it, and let it sit for anywhere from 6 to 12 hours, that little 1 ounce piece of old starter will act as a seed and it will awaken and, you know, inoculate the new flour, and you'll have an 8 ounce piece of starter. Now you can build that into a much larger piece of starter by doing the same ratios after that new starter has doubled in size. You can, you know, use it to make larger starters. Or if you wanted a larger starter to begin with, take 3 ounces of old starter and multiply that by 3. So then you would use by 4, I'm sorry. So that would be 12 ounces of flour and about 8 ounces or 9 ounces of water. And all of a sudden you've got almost a pound and a half, you know, of starter. So you can build it up very quickly by just, you know, starting with a very small piece, and within a couple of days, you're up and running again.
Cool.
So never give up on your starter. The only time I ever throw it out is if for some reason the inside walls of the container are covered in mold, like a grayish or black or blue mold. That usually means that the side walls of your container were not cleaned enough. You know, they got a little smear of dough on there, but not enough of the natural organisms in that dough to fend off the invading organisms that form mold. So a new kind of bacteria or fungus got a hold of that starter and ruined it. And that can happen. So that's why I always advise, if you're going to put your starter away and not use it for a while, put it in a clean container. Make sure you clean the sidewalls of your container and let it sit there, because it will protect itself as it goes dormant.
Cool. Let's talk about some little bit of different ingredients. You're a fan of instant yeast, and you recommend it in all your books. And so I've been doing that. When I worked with that French guy in New Jersey, because New Jersey commercially has available the fresh yeast, that's what we used. Uh-huh. Now, fresh yeast, having lived in Florida, go to a grocery store in Florida, and they don't know what you're talking about, because it's just too hot always. In New Jersey, I could find it. Here in Oregon, I can find it. And in some part of the dairy coolers, and it's the little teeny silver Fleshman Freshies packets, and they work great. Yeah. But if you don't use them rapidly, they dry out and they go moldy. Something else happens to them, yeah. So you've wasted money. So because I know how to use it, I enjoy fresh yeast when I can. What is, to you, the advantage of instant yeast over active dry yeast?
Well, so now we're really talking about three types of yeast. There's the fresh yeast, which is, like you said, it's moist. It's about 80% moisture and then about 20% carbohydrate and microscopic yeast cells. And that's what bakers use, professional bakers like to use it because they just love the feel of it and the smell of it. And it's very reliable when it's fresh. But it only has about the 2 to 3 week shelf life before it kind of exhausts itself because it is so moist that even in the refrigerator, the yeast doesn't go totally to sleep. It continues to work and eats up all the nutrients that are in that cake that was in. So it eventually becomes not only less potent, but also it kind of becomes mealy and putty-like. So you have to get rid of it. So you want to use it within the first week to 2 weeks of when you get it. Active dry yeast was the first kind of extension of that, where the Fleischmann brothers figured out a way to dry that fresh yeast on drums that would spin around and dry until they kind of dehydrated and turned into a powder. But in the process of drying the yeast, about 25% of the living yeast cells died. So once they collected those, and what you see in a packet of yeast is the carbohydrate base made partly from molasses and other foods that yeast love to feed on while they're multiplying. So you're seeing the dried molasses, so to speak. You're not seeing the yeast because it's microscopic, but it's there lying dormant on this dry grain. And it has a shelf life of, about a year if you keep it, sealed so it doesn't draw moisture from the air. So that's one advantage of any kind of dry yeast is long shelf life. But about 40 years ago, the yeast companies came up with a new strain of yeast, a type of Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which all the yeasts are in that family, but a kind of a cousin of the yeast that have been the dominant beer and bread yeast up to that point. And they found that when they dried that yeast, they could not only dry it even more than the active dry yeast. Active dry yeast is about 5% moisture and instant yeast is about 3% moisture. So it's hardly any moisture left in those granules. And none of the yeast died. So a teaspoon of instant yeast is actually 25% more potent than a teaspoon of active dry yeast because it doesn't have any dead yeast in it. And not only that, but because it's dried to such a fine grain that you could put it right in your flour. You didn't have to hydrate it first in water to wake it up. And so it activated instantly when it got wet. And that's why they called it instant yeast, not because it makes the dough rise faster, but because it wakes up instantly. Now, it will make the dough rise faster if you don't reduce the amount that you're using, because if you're used to using a teaspoon of active dry yeast and you use a teaspoon of instant yeast, you're actually using 25% more yeast in the bread than the recipe called for. So you have to reduce it by 25%. So after a while, as bakers started switching over to this more convenient product, the recipes and the formulas were written with that 25% reduction sort of built into the recipe. So then the question becomes, okay, I have a recipe and it calls for one kind of yeast, but I don't have that yeast. I have another kind of yeast. Can I swap them out? And the answer is yes, but you have to substitute the amount that you use. So if the recipe called for active dry yeast, then you need 25% less instant yeast. If it calls for instant yeast and you need because you only have active dry yeast, then you have to increase the amount by 25%. And if you have fresh yeast, then typically you would multiply times 3. Instant yeast is about 1/3 more potent, or it's 300% more potent, which means you only need to use 1/3 the amount of fresh yeast. So all these yeasts are interchangeable, and there are written formulas. You can just go to the web and say a yeast substitution, and it will give you the chart, and it'll say some, you know, how to multiply the, you know, the amount if you're using a different kind of yeast. It's a pretty basic formulation. But yeah, they're all interchangeable.
There is actually a website called the Yeast Converter, and it will calculate to, I don't know how many, because I only do two, but you can change teaspoons, tablespoons, cups, grams, ounces of one to the other. Now, it's a little clunky to use, but it's very effective. Just like, man, this is a great thing, because I'm doing this all the time. A lot of my recipes are written in fresh yeast. I'm like, well, all right, now how many grams of instant yeast do I need? Yeah. So I'm not bothering this math. I'm just going to go let the computer do it.
Amazing how these websites and the internet has almost made it unnecessary to have cookbooks anymore, you know, or to have, you know, these books, because all the calculations are done for you. You don't even need to have a calculator anymore. You can just go there and say, you know, when you put in the converter, the number that it called for, and then you tell, and they say, okay, now how much do I need of this other kind? And it just calculates it right there for you. I still like to know how to do it. So I like kind of running it on my little pocket calculator.
Sure. And it's a good skill to have in case, for whatever reason, the computer's not there.
That's true. Well, let me just say one final statement. The basic formula is real simple. 33% instant yeast equals 50% active dry yeast equals 100% fresh yeast.
Okay, well, that's pretty simple.
So that's your basic formula. Yeah.
And for any amount that someone's going to be making at home, whatever calculation error we've got isn't going to make a big difference.
Right.
You're mixing 100 pounds of flour, you might want to get a little bit more precise.
Correct.
Okay. But let's talk for a minute about bakers who don't yet know they're bakers. So people who like to do it, but they just think that this is something they enjoy. Who knows what they think? Yeah. What can you recommend to get them started into some success and some reinforcing activities? Maybe biscuits, muffins. How do we lead the young, inexperienced bakers to greater successes?
Yeah, good question. Well, the first thing I would suggest is, if anybody has an interest and a passion for baking and would like to maybe take it deeper, to consider joining the Bread Bakers Guild of America, bbga.org. The best single resource for professional or serious home bakers, you know, probably in the world. And it is an association made up of couple thousand professional bakers, and probably another thousand what we call serious enthusiasts, home bakers, and the information that comes out in the quarterly bulletins, the backlog of articles and recipes and formulas and technical pieces that have been written by members and shared with each other are priceless. And if you are a new member, you can ask them for access to the old newsletters and get all that. And I've been trying to persuade them, and I think they're looking into it to actually put a book together, to compile all the wisdom that they've gathered over the 25 years that the organization's been in existence, and actually publish a book that can, you know, that consolidates all that information. But more importantly, it puts you in touch with a network of bakers that are so inspiring, and you get to see things that they make. They share their tips and techniques. And you, as a member, you get to go to workshops that are only open to guild members that are held all around the country. So it's worth it. The membership, I don't know what it is anymore for a home baker. It's probably about $80 a year. I'd say try it. It's worth every penny. That's number one. And then two, yeah, I think you're right. Starting with some products that you love to eat and love to make. Whether it's quick breads like banana bread or poppy seed breads or muffins, which are all these fall in the quick bread category. They're leavened with baking powder or baking soda, just to get the ball rolling. That's how I started years ago when I was, you know, just out of college and got involved with a local organic restaurant. One of the ways that we kind of launched it was to bake banana breads and carrot breads in loaf pans. And we would sell, this is back in 1971, We would sell a slice of this bread for 25 cents and we'd sell the whole loaf for like $3. And now you could probably get $15 or $20 for that same loaf. But it got me, you know, it got the juices going for baking. And the more you do it, it just, you know, some of it just seeps into your cells through osmosis. And then the more you start to read about it, you know, the science behind it or the reason why, the rationale on why we do certain things, the functionality of ingredients. Why do we use fats and sugars and oils and eggs? What do each of these contribute? That's all part of the learning process. And it happens over time. You do it for fun. Don't worry about necessarily becoming a student of it until you get, you know, inspired to do so. And then there's lots of material, whether it's from the Guild or from the wonderful cookbooks that are out there and websites now that will fill you with information and the science behind it, the rationale behind it. You know, and if you get so deep into it, then eventually you'll go, hey, yeah, I want to get one of those modernist bread collections, you know, that cost $600. I mean, there are people that now are, you know, not even professional bakers, but they want to have the whole set because they're so into bread that whether they do it professionally or not, they just want to know everything there is to know about bread. So that, you know, there's degrees of the learning curve, but the learning curve actually happens pretty fast by just making the products and then, you know, asking, you know, why are these ingredients working to create this kind of a product. In the end, you know, what a bread really is when you think about it is it's just solid foam. It's a foam made out of the ingredients that you've mixed together. And what makes it foamy is the leavening, whether it's yeast or baking powder, it creates carbon dioxide. So it expands the product and creates essentially a piece of foam, a piece of delicious edible foam that, you know, is solid, unlike like a foam that chefs use now, like foamed seawater or something like that, you know, that kind of exists for 5 seconds until you get a bite of it and then it dissolves in your mouth. This is a solid foam that, you know, that tastes better the more you chew it. But think of it, you know, that just, and then work it back from there. You know, you've created a solid, delicious piece of foam. How did that happen? You know, what's the magic behind it? And it can open up a whole world of interest for you.
While your scientific evaluation may be spot on, no articulation possible will make foam sound appealing.
I know, but I kind of, when I got that idea by talking to the folks that have done the modernist cookbooks, and you know, and they became, they got on the landscape. I mean, molecular gastronomy kind of burst on the scene. I think foams were the leading edge because it was such a unique idea that you could have this ephemeral little flavor burst that would then disappear. And so I was talking with them about breads, and they're saying, yeah, when you think about it, you know, bread is just a foam also. It's just more solid. It's a solid foam. And I thought, you know, that's true. And if you start from that premise, then it starts a whole line of questioning, like, why does a foam taste, how can a foam taste this good and linger in, you know, on your palate and in your olfactory system for hours after you eat it, that with every breath that you take, you re-experience the flavors of that once piece of foam that has dissolved into your, you know, in your mouth and is now in your stomach, and yet you're still tasting it a couple hours later. And that's because of the fermentation. I'm talking about like sourdough breads now, where the flavors just linger in your olfactory system for a long, long time. It's pretty amazing.
It is pretty amazing. And it's fun when that happens. Let's talk for a minute about procedure. Now, I mentioned that American mixers, bakers tend to, I think, probably put water in the bowl first, then add the flour. I've read cookbooks which have the reverse as the case. Muffins have very distinctly their own procedure. Do you find, now the adherence to the rules is one thing, but using adherence to the rules to the point of not following through and not making things, well, then that's a different issue. But is there a difference, do you find, between in muffins, putting the wet on the dry or putting the dry in the wet? Does it really make a difference for batters or doughs, or what's going on?
Again, I think it comes down to the functionality. For starting with yeasted bread, leavened bread, it really doesn't matter if you put the dry in first and then the water or vice versa. What matters is to have a system that you follow, you know, each and every time, because that way you won't forget to put an ingredient in. So a lot of bakers like to put the liquid in first so that none of the flour sticks to the bottom of your mixer. But it shouldn't stick to the bottom of your mixer anyway. But and then what I'll do is sometimes I usually put my dry ingredients in first, because I like to kind of whisk them together and separate the salt and everything and get it buried in the dry ingredients. And then I put my water in, and I'll hold a little bit of water back to drizzle down the side of the bowl at the end to pick up any loose flour that didn't get picked up by the dough hook or the paddle. So in one sense, it doesn't matter which order you do it in, just as long as you have a system that you like that works for you, that allows you to not forget to put the salt in or to put the yeast in or to put the baking powder in or whatever you're making, you know, follow the system. Then in terms of quick breads, because there are different mixing methods for quick breads, like muffins and biscuits and things like that. And it all depends on the ingredients that you're using. If you're using, for instance, a solid fat like butter or margarine or coconut shortening or even shortening, you know, we don't see too much of the use of Crisco anymore because now we think it's, you know, basically killing us. But bakers still do use it. And so any kind of solid shortening, which is very functional fat, lard is another good functional fat, that we usually cream it with the sugar and some of the other dry ingredients to start to break it down and smooth it out to create an emulsion that kind of comes together when we add the eggs. Because typically with quick breads, there's going to be some eggs involved. And so the eggs have natural lecithin in the yolk, and they will emulsify any of the liquids, and the fats and the liquids will emulsify to create kind of a fluffy paste. So we call that the creaming method. We're creaming the fat with sugars and other dry ingredients, adding the eggs, and then only then do we add the dry ingredients very slowly with a paddle to just mixing it long enough for the dry ingredients to disappear into this emulsion. That's with the creaming method. But then if you're using liquid oil, you can't really create that emulsion in the same way because it's liquid. And so what you do is that you can get all your liquid ingredients together and then just put dry ingredients in one big shot, and you can mix it together very quickly. So they have different, they rise differently, they taste differently, but they're both quick breads. So those are both, like, you know, methods. With biscuits, we have solid fat, and we cut them in, and we make little pieces of fat that adhere to pieces of the flour to create weak spots. And then eventually when we add our liquid, it kind of brings together to make a coarse dough that when it bakes allows the biscuits to be tender, because the fat, as it melts, actually interferes with gluten development, which is why we call it shortening. Shortening means it shortens the gluten, and it makes the biscuits more tender and crumbly, which is what we like in a biscuit. We want that to happen, or a pie dough, which is another kind of biscuit dough. So all these things are really dependent on the functionality of your ingredients, and the mixing methods, follow the function of the, of what you're trying to achieve. So that's why there are so many ways of doing it, and it's not like there's a wrong way. There are wrong ways, but there are many ways sometimes to put a dough together.
You mentioned the creaming method, and I'm of a particular group of bakers that insists muffins never need a mixing bowl. It's all by hand. There's no creaming involved. So even if it's butter, it's melted. And the sugar and the buttermilk all go together, and then just the wet onto the dry and fold it up.
Well, if you're melting the butter, then you turn it into an oil. So then you go to the other method we described, which is called the blending method, which is as if you were using vegetable oil instead of melted butter. And that's where you take all your liquid and put them together, and then you get all your dry, put them together, and then combine them and mix them in a bowl. You know, you're right. You don't need a mix. You don't need an electric mixer to do that. You can just do it with a spoon. But that's because you've melted the butter. But if you want the butter to have a different function, which is to create an emulsion with the sugar and the eggs, then you would need to cream them. And the difference is the way the muffins rise. A muffin that's been made with the creaming method will have a more of a rounded dome and rise slightly higher overall than a muffin made with the creaming method, which tends to have a more volcanic type dome. And only the peak of the volcano gets kind of high, and the rest of the muffin kind of stays a little bit behind. And that's just the result of the mixing method that's being used. Both valid, by the way. There's no wrong way. They're both valid ways of making muffins.
Well, it's the emotional commitment to one over the other.
Yeah, right.
And there's no shortage.
When you find a technique that works for you and you love, then stick with it. There's no reason to switch. If you find something that works, then you don't have to reinvent it unless you want to.
I wrote a whole muffin e-cookbook about just that thing. And I admit it's totally emotional, but the creaming means it's a cake. Muffin has its own thing, but that's
there you go. That sounds like a whole philosophy of baking.
I think that it is, and it isn't a right versus wrong as much as it is. It's strictly opinion, right. But it's a firmly.
Are you a Platonist or an Aristotelian? Well, which is something we could explore the next time that we get together.
Well, we'll have to do that because I'm gonna cut some questions off, but I want to ask this last one.
Okay.
And that is your thoughts on the future of bread. And in particular, I have a focus part of this question. There is a cottage industry that's just growing across the country, which is, if people don't know what a cottage industry means, it's that you go to your local farmer's market and you're buying bread made from Grandma Sally or Uncle Jim, or even in some cases, you can go to someone's house and the state's rules change, but you can buy pretzels or biscuits or muffins from them at their house. And do you see large commercial baking losing a step as we're getting a little bit more decentralized? And then this sounds like we're getting right back to Brother Juniper's making carrot loaf and other just loaf breads as a community.
Yeah.
Do you see this happening? Is this just a
I think it's a subculture, you know, and it's a good thing that see these small little almost at home bakeries that sell their breads at the farmer's market or off the back of a tailgate or something like that. It's a wonderful thing. And a lot of bakers, large bakeries today started that way, you know, whether it's Pepperidge Farm or you know, a lot of the more recent bakeries, a lot of them started that way. And it's great for us to not lose the ability to bake bread ourselves and at home and to pass that wisdom on and skill on to our next generations. You know, 150 years ago, 80% of the bread in America was baked by home bakers. And then, you know, as automation came in and industrialization, now, you know, maybe, you know, a couple percentage points of people bake at home. And it's a wonderful thing to see it coming back. And like a lot of crafts and beer making is an example where there was consolidation, you know, 100 years ago and all these small craft breweries disappeared to five big breweries. Now the craft brewing movement is huge and now everybody's making beer. And so we're seeing that with bread as well. It's a good thing. It's a good thing. And then what will happen is that some of these cottage bakeries will grow into a larger bakery. And they might even grow large enough that at a certain point when people go, my God, I've been doing this for 20 years. I haven't made that much money. I'm worn out. I'm tired. But I have somebody who wants to buy this from me. I'm going to sell it and I'll be able to actually get my life back. And sometimes it will get sold to like what happened to La Brea Bakery, which was a small little bakery out of LA with by Nancy Silverton. That was just, she sold it out of her restaurant. And now it's one of the largest bakeries in the world because it kept getting bought by bigger and bigger companies. And that's a dance that will never end. We call it in the bread world, in terms of the future of bread, which we talk about at our bread symposium, the notion of craft at scale, meaning how can I preserve the craft of these handmade artisan loaves at a scale that will allow me to make a really good living and feed more people, meaning automation, meaning machines and large equipment. You know, how do I do that? And a few years ago, it wasn't really possible. It was one or the other, because the industry, the technology wasn't there to create a artisan quality loaf. But amazingly now, the technology is there. And there is some phenomenal artisan breads being produced in large scales. And some of the most well-known artisan bakers have moved into that sector, like Chad Robertson from Tartine, and of course, Nancy Silverton from La Brea and others. They've shown the way that it can be done. Are there trade-offs? Yes, there's always trade-offs. But from a craft standpoint, we know that it can happen. And I think that a lot of people get into it. They may start, you know, in the idealism of doing it for fun and, you know, pick up a few extra bucks at the farmer's market. But also at the back of their mind might be the hope that they could build an actual brick and mortar business out of this and make a living out of it, and something that would support their family. And that's a hard thing to do because, you know, you have to make a lot of loaves of bread to make serious money, because the profit margin is just not that big on a loaf of bread. That's why a lot of bakeries survive, move into sandwiches, because they're going to make a lot more money on sandwiches and coffee than they are on the loaf of bread. The Panera model, of which there's now thousands of Paneras, you know, use the idea of the bread as the symbol of, to draw people in. It was the hook, but that was never where they made their money. Panera always made their money on food and on coffee and on beverages, not on selling loaves of bread or muffins, but people would come in for those things. And so, you know, this is the dance, and it's, you know, and the balancing act between doing something for love and doing something, you know, for livelihood. And it's, you know, it's part of life.
It is a delicate balance.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's always trade-offs. I mean, I know that when Panera started out about 20 some years ago, you know, their dream was to be able to do highest quality artisan breads in a multi-location universe of Panera's. And I think they realized, you know, somewhere along the line that was unrealistic. They could do good breads. They could do serviceable breads and decent muffins. And, you know, but that's not sustainable, because it's too hard to have quality control over that many units and places and everything. But that they could still control it enough to have good quality product, and that good was good enough. Whereas for an artisan baker who's got a single location, whose craft is at stake with every loaf that he or she makes, then, you know, it has to be about the quality of each loaf, not about, you know, how many people I can feed with these breads. But each loaf has to speak for itself, and hopefully I can make enough money to, you know, come to work the next day as well.
The artist in me hears the phrase "good is good enough," and it's a dagger to my heart.
Yeah,
and I used to write in my syllabus, and not that anybody read it. Do not settle for adequate. Adequate is failing. Who hears? Nobody remembers adequate.
Yeah,
and that's a whole other philosophy of pedagogical philosophy that is maybe for another episode, but
we do need people to have that, to be in that, have that position, that, you know, to hold the fort at quality, because if we don't, then everything will just go to adequate, because it becomes more practical to do it that way. But that's why the artisan community and the craft community is so important, is to keep those standards so that the next generation can know what great is, instead of just knowing what good is. They want to know what great is. They want to know what excellence is. And there have to be some people that are committed to continuing to make that excellence, even if they can't make the same kind of money that they could make by going to multi-units.
Right. And that's, and again, so we're back to the delicate balance.
Yeah.
And
it's a dance that will never end. Cool to be in the dance.
Yeah. I'm encroaching on some of your time here. So one last thing. Do you have any recommendations of books? So Christmas is coming It really is, folks. I'm sorry to tell you. It's going to be your fascinating thing. Right. So obviously you may recommend your own, but if there's some other books that you say, wow, this is really a great resource for building skills and building success for young inexperienced bakers.
There's a new sourdough book. It was not that new anymore. It's been out a year or so, by Sarah Owens, who's a home baker who's just decided to tackle and master the art and craft of sourdough bread baking. So for people who want to get into sourdough, that's a wonderful book. It's just called Sourdough. And the author's name is Sarah Owens. We had her speak at our most recent bread symposium, and she's very accessible. So I think that's a good tool. You know, I've been putting a lot of my attention lately in the pizza world. So my new book is called Perfect Pan Pizzas, in which we talk about, you know, how to make pizzas that do take a few hours and, you know, to make in a pan, but the recipes are fun and simple, and the dough is not hard to make, and it will teach you how to handle wet, sticky dough without getting it all over your clothes and your, you know, not getting it, be able to get it off your hands. And it's a fun book, and the pictures are great and the recipes are great. So of course I'd love for people to take a look at that. You know, and for bread baking in general, going back a ways, my own book, Bread Baker's Apprentice, the 15th anniversary edition, it came out a couple of years ago, which just basically builds on the one on the early version that won all sorts of awards back in about 17 years ago. But then Jeffrey Hamelman's book called Bread, A Baker's, I think it's called Bread, A Baker's Journal, something like that,
yeah,
is a good book for people that want to move into the more advanced techniques. Flour, Water, Salt, Yeast.
Oh,
by Ken,
yeah.
Frickish, by Ken, and who's is a terrific book. All those, and those are just among the dozens and dozens of great bread books that are out there, and baking books, but they've been out for a while. They're not new. I think all those, though, are worth having. If you're going to get into baking, those are all worth having in your bread library. And if you get into pizza making, then Tony Gemignani's book, The Pizza Bible, is worth having. Ken Forkish also wrote a terrific pizza book called, I think it's called, is it called The Elements of Pizza or something? So there's more and more pizza books coming out these days because not only for the first time, not only are people eating a lot of pizza, but now people want to make pizza. And so so we're seeing a kind of a resurgence of great pizza making books, which, remember, pizza is just bread with something on it. So it keeps us in the bread category, but it tells you what else you can do with that bread, and people never get tired of pizza.
No.
So those are the ones those are the ones I'm aware of right now that I would suggest people look into.
I will put a link. Today's show notes will be culinarylibertarian.com/51, and I'll put a link to our recent conversation about your Perfect Pan Pizza book.
And
it's just in case they want to hear it and talk, you know, get the details about it. And I still remain a huge fan of the Bread Baker's Apprentice. It's the binding is nearly shot. So
yeah, thank you. That's a great compliment there.
it's very well used. That's for sure. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. I know I've gone over what you said was your limit, so I want to be respectful of that. But thank you so much for making time for me today. I really do appreciate it.
Well, thank you. And thank everyone for listening in, too. And if you want to stay in touch with me, are you going to give them a link to me, Dan?
Absolutely. Go ahead. Tell us how to get a hold of you. I will also put a link on the page.
Write to me at peter@pizzaquest.com. PizzaQuest is one word. And that also will get to me. That's in my email box. But then you can also check out my PizzaQuest website by just going to pizzaquest.com. That's the easiest way to reach me. If you have any questions, I'm happy to follow up.
Awesome. Well, thanks again. I really appreciate it. Have a fabulous rest of the week, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you. You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, folks, that's going to do it. I'll put a link on today's show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/51, to the Amazon page featuring Peter's cookbooks. It's late August as of this recording, and if you are that person who has Christmas shopping done by Thanksgiving, I can help you with your gifts for your baker. check the show notes page for my affiliate banner to Bake Deco, which sells a wide variety of professional baking tools and pans and utensils, but not at professional prices. I'm not convinced a $400 pan is superior to the same style pan for $100, but I am pretty certain crummy pans produce crummy baked goods. Flimsy, thin pans from the grocery store are not gonna cut it. Check out the selection at Bake Deco and bake some success. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon. Music for the Culinary Libertarian Podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.
Okay.
Stressful for a home baker isn't the same as stressful for a restaurant cook, but when you're elbow deep in flour, you don't really care how your stress relates to somebody else.
Right.
It's just like, yeah, it's just, it's a horrible place to be. And if we can find some way to help people navigate that and avoid it, well, that seems like a good thing.
All right, let's do it.